If you could feel the heat and sweat of the tropics, if you could hear the noise of battle and sense the fears, if you could put yourself on the other side of the world where you're the selectee of your government to advise and help a unit of foreign fighters defend their village, and if you and that unit are at this moment in combat, but they're being slow to react, you might come close to understanding how I felt one day in 1969 in the Mekong Delta of Vietnam. The enemy were in a nearby tree line. They had taken us under fire and bullets were cutting leaves from the trees. We already had wounded, one man shot in the foot, another in the side. Everyone had gone to ground, and the Vietnamese officer, my counterpart, was down behind a small dike with some of his soldiers. He was fixed in place, not taking the lead. I was an American infantry officer there to provide assistance when possible and leadership when necessary. Frustrated at our slow reaction, I ran toward my counterpart, intent on getting him to lead his men. But as I made my way, a background program had already begun running in my mind. It asked, "What are you doing here? Is this ever going to mean anything?" I was in Vietnam because the United States had decided to assist an ally in fighting an insurgency stimulated and supplied from across international boundaries. The rights and wrongs of our intervention were a matter of vigorous debate, but that debate was not mine. I was an Army officer, trained in counterinsurgency, and I was in Vietnam to lead a small advisory team in a remote village near the Cambodian border. We were doing counterinsurgency focused on two things, improving village security and encouraging local development. Improving security meant improving the fighting skills of the local militia. They were poorly equipped and poorly led, neither of which helped morale. Improving their fighting skills meant going into combat with them, fighting beside them, and learning firsthand what it means to fight a guerrilla war. Encouraging development meant helping local officials initiate projects meant to improve community life. The main enemies to security were the local guerrillas. The main enemy to development was a corrupt bureaucracy. We finally made our assault that day back in 69. When my counterpart proved hesitant, I knew the leadership had fallen to me. I signaled to my American teammate on the operation that we were moving out. Then he and I, waving and shouting at the others, began to maneuver against the enemy's tree line. The unit followed our lead. Our delay had allowed most of the enemy to slip away. It was not an uncommon result, the reasons for which are complex and range from the military to the religious and everything in between. That is why counterinsurgency is such a complicated task, and I know because I have done it. With that as a background, you might imagine my concern during the last decade as my country has made its way into two counterinsurgency wars at the same time and has bumped first into one problem, then another. Our ineptness at the enterprise has been frustrating because the difficulties reported have seemed so predictable. I know what it means to do counterinsurgency. I know what it means to do war in the village, and I know from the outside looking in how large American units, simply because of their size and American nature, can perturb a local culture and make friends into enemies without really meaning to. I also know counterinsurgency is not won by firepower alone. It is won by a government attracting the loyalty of its own people. And if Vietnam taught us anything, it is that we can help an ally do that, but we cannot do the job by ourselves. The host government has to be interested and active in winning that basic loyalty. Those were my thoughts in 2003, 4, and 5 when we had American, British, and other allied soldiers fighting wars in two different countries where even the people claiming to be our friends wanted us gone as soon as possible. It was maddening. The American military had had decades of counterinsurgency experience in Asia, Latin America, and even Europe. Where were the lessons learned manuals? Had no one read them? Was no one paying attention? In 1985, I had written a book entitled Once a Warrior King about my experiences in Vietnam. The book had been well received, and on the basis of it alone, in 2006, I was invited to attend an Army conference where then Lieutenant General David Petraeus was commanding. The conference was interesting but disheartening. It became clear that many of the lessons learned about counterinsurgency in Vietnam and elsewhere had been lost from our institutional memory. General Petraeus acknowledged that and said the loss had occurred in the 1990s as the American military had been rebalanced after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Now, in 2006, those old lessons were having to be relearned in Iraq and Afghanistan. That was a hard thing for former advisors to hear. Lessons and principles that should have been learned partly from our own sweat and blood had been discarded like a pair of old shoes gone out of fashion. That was not good. So what are some of these important lessons? First, ask some damn questions before you get involved and hear the answers unfiltered by political agendas. From the American perspective, the leading question ought to be, what are the U.S. interests in the host country, and are they sufficiently vital to require American action? South Vietnam eventually fell to North Vietnam, but with no consequences to us other than the high price we had paid to help a friend who in some ways would not be helped. Another question. What is the level of internal support for the host government? A narrowly supported, entrenched oligarchy does not bode well for a counterinsurgency effort. On the other hand, entrenched and unpopular does not mean irremediable. So the next key question is, what is the host government's willingness and ability to make the changes necessary for winning the loyalty of its people? Absent that willingness and ability, no counterinsurgency program will succeed, and this is an important point because it is aimed at preventing the Saigon syndrome, that condition wherein the strong are pulled down by the weak. The heaviest drag downward is government corruption. It is a cancer that destroys from within. In Vietnam, corruption meant, among other things, that officials would buy or sell government jobs, peddle influence, or divert procurements for their own profit. Such practices devalue a government in the eyes of its own people, and in that way actually feed the insurgency. So what has come of our more recent counterinsurgency efforts? Not much, I fear. Our military is now out of Iraq, and in that stew of government obliquity and secular animosities, no claims of success can be made until we know what kind of government survives in the long run. The possibilities there remain troubling. In Afghanistan, the war continues, but that is a place of even lower promise. The Afghan government remains famously corrupt and appears either unwilling or unable to make changes. Some allied officials have tried to dismiss corruption as a cultural matter and in that way deflect calls for action. That is a mistake. Ignoring corruption now means the Afghan government will suffer for it later. Its people will remain disaffected while its enemy operates with two strong motivations, religious fervor and ethnic xenophobia. The mullahs in the hills and valleys declaim against our presence today exactly as they did against British forces a century and a half ago. I hope I'm wrong, but I fear things there will not turn out well. Overall, it is hard to escape the adage that the main thing we learn from history is that we don't learn much from history. And those old questions from 1969 come to mind again. What are we doing? Is it ever going to mean anything?
The retired academic David Donovan.